Go on then.
Well, just two things really, and both of which are not, you know, they're a little on the light-hearted side really. John, thanks ever so much. That was a great talk, and it's such a massive subject to try and cover. So well done. It's much appreciated. I'm sure everybody enjoyed it. One thing that made me laugh actually was the Life of Brian thing and Mary Whitehouse, actually, because Mary Whitehouse, even though I knew, well, recognised who she is, I was a little boy at the time when she was on the television, you know, pontificating, but she actually lives in a village very close to where I live, or lived in a village very close to where I lived. And I think she was a primary school teacher. And it's odd, really. She's sort of quietly forgotten now, really. It's not something that is much mentioned in the local area, really. But I saw a hysterical sketch, again, when I was much, much younger, on it was a program, a satirical program, comedy satire, the 9 o'clock news, and they reversed the Life of Brian thing, and they said, oh, there's this thing called the Life of Jesus Christ, and they just reversed it all round, you know, and they were having a debate about it and how awful it was that the film had made a mockery of our Lord JC. Of course, John Cleese, you know, so it was really very, very well done. If you look that up on YouTube, I'm sure it will amuse people. But then, like, slightly more serious sort of perspective on this. And I think, like, possibly some of the rest of us, the internet is such a big kind of arena to navigate, that, you know, certainly for myself, you know, I find some of it quite daunting sometimes, and I certainly don't get into things like these political discussion groups where people argue people into the ground and all that sort of thing. I haven't got the time to do it in the first place, and secondly, I think I'd find it quite soul destroying, really. So it just made me sort of rewind and think, well, you know, my essential sort of perspective on things is I'm an old-fashioned Marxist, really. What would Karl Marx think about all of this? And I think Karl Marx would probably think about it pretty much in the same way as, you know, as I do, that it's like the print press, really. The print press was a great opportunity to liberate the voice of people. But within that, there are two aspects, really. We have to sort of uphold the absolute freedom of speech. You know, that's a very, very important principle. And very, very simply, also that the print press gave rise to a lot of abstract nonsense, basically, you know, ghost stories and all sorts of things that people sort of enjoyed reading. Probably I like reading ghost stories and, you know, things like that. I don't believe them, of course, you know, there's a little bit of light relief and fun, you know, and so on. And at the same time, the print press gave rise to very serious literature and political expression as well, and it democratized that to a certain extent. Well, it democratized it to a massive extent. You know, there's always been card sharps and thimble riggers and people who try to hoodwink us at every turn, you know, throughout sort of the history of capitalism. Really, before that, with all the religion and you know, irrationality that went on and so on before the Enlightenment took hold and so on. So I see it in the same way, really. And that's basically all I would like to say. I just thought I would kick things off like that. And I'm very sorry that I put my hand up to chair. If you really want me to do it, Paddy, I'll have a go. I don't think I've done it before.
It's pretty easy. Just call out whoever puts a hand up, Andy.
Fair enough. All right. I'll give it a go then.
Okay.
All right. Thanks. Who would like to speak? I've got a hand up from the Socialist Party meeting. I'm not quite sure who that is. Hello?
That's me.
Oh, that's you, Paddy. Hi.
I've just renamed myself, yeah. I was... it was when John was talking about von Daniken. In the past, I've referred to von Daniken as being... my rite of passage from complete credulity into some sort of the beginnings of, you know, critical ability. But two other people I remember from youth who deserve honourable mention are the wonderful Lobsang Rampa, who published a lot of books. I remember when I was a kid, loads of hipster type people had these books, shelves of them. Sometimes some people had read all of them. This was a guy who was supposedly a Buddhist monk or a Dalai Lama or something like that, who'd been kind of re-hosted in a Western body, and he wrote loads of books, and people absolutely lapped it up, even after he was outed as a plumber from Devon. People completely bought into this stuff, and he had a long and successful career pretending to be a Buddhist monk, even though the Dalai Lama himself said, well, this is completely fictitious, it's completely made up. And the other person I thought deserves mention is Emmanuel Velikovsky, who I came across in my 20s, who he was the original sort of von Daniken, but his sort of catastrophist theory of the cosmos in chaos, and, you know, Mars sort of causing the fall of the walls of Jericho, and Venus causing all sorts of other biblical catastrophes and the plagues of Egypt and stuff. Absolutely wonderful, rip-roaring stuff. And Velikovsky was compared to Einstein when he was first published. That's how big an impact he made. It was all absolute tosh. All of it was complete tosh, but it had such an amazing sort of breadth of reading that he took an awful lot of people in. Wonderful stuff, really entertaining. Nobody's heard of these people now, you know, they're forgotten, and, you know, quite rightly so, really. But I suppose I mention them just to sort of, I don't know, embellish John's point about these people who existed before the internet, and they were huge. Everybody at the time read them. They were being talked about in Time magazine, in New York Review of Books. You know, these were the top sellers of the 1950s. So, and I suppose what little point that I'm rambling towards here is just to say that I think nowadays, you know, all you've got to do is just look up Lobsang Rampa on Wikipedia, or look up Velikovsky, or look up von Daniken, or look up his modern equivalent, which is Graham Hancock, who is still putting out these most egregious piles of crap on the only British TV channel that will host his stuff, which is Channel 4, because they just really don't care at all. But you can look these people up, and in seconds you can find that they're completely rejected as pseudoscience. You know, it's pseudoscience, it's pseudo-history, it's pseudo-everything. So I think that's one of the enduring benefits that the internet has brought is that, okay, yeah, there is a lot of crap out there, and also there are a lot of idiots out there who just believe anything that they're told, and they don't have the first conception about how to sort of check. But for anybody who does want to check, it's really, really easy now. I think that if there are people out there who insist on believing the sort of rubbish that Graham Hancock puts out, it's because they're determined to believe it, like flat earthers, like moon hoaxers, like QAnon. They absolutely determined to believe this, and it doesn't matter whether there's an internet or not, because they won't listen to anybody who doesn't agree with them. They won't listen to anybody who tells them to be critical, or to, you know, do comparative studies, or to, well, just do better research. They don't want to know the truth, you know, that's the fact. And I don't think the internet makes any difference to people like that. They don't want to know. But that isn't most people. That's a few people. Most people, I think, have derived and will continue to derive enormous benefit from the internet, as we in fact are doing in this very meeting.
Yeah, thanks, Paddy. And I would agree with you on that, actually. Personally speaking, I think the internet's been a great bonus for people across the world, and certainly the benefits outweigh the disadvantages. It's really a case of being able to use it in the right way. It's like any tool or technology, isn't it? You know, I mean, even a motor car, if driven badly and wrongly, can be a instrument basically can kill people with them very easily, you know, and sometimes that happens. So yeah, certainly agree with that. Any other contributions forthcoming? Mike, hello, Mike.
Hello there. Yep. Cheers. Yeah. Thanks. Thanks for the interesting talk, John. And I enjoyed that. Yeah, and you know, it's an interesting discussion so far. Just before the meeting started, I was having a look on the BBC website, and there was an article there about the delivery firm DPD, and they've got on their website, they've got like an AI chatbot that you're supposed to use if you've got, you know, inquiries about your delivery, that runs on an AI algorithm. And people had worked out that you could train this AI chatbot to give sort of sweary responses or criticize DPD, and that there was one that, you know, that asked it to write a haiku saying how useless DPD was, and it, you know, the AI chatbot replied with a haiku with a sort of jokey little criticism of, you know, the company that produced this bit of AI software. And so, you know, that's all been very embarrassing for DPD, of course, but you know, it's one of those sort of new AI things that we're going to have to sort of get used to, isn't it? You know, the way that AI has shaped is going to shape the, you know, the internet that we've sort of just about getting our heads around how to use. And I suppose that makes me think that, you know, political discourse could be sort of impacted by AI. You know, I'm guessing it'd be possible to, you know, type into AI, you know, please write me an argument in favour of a moneyless society. You know, you click the return key, the AI algorithm does its job, draws in from a few articles, hopefully from the SPGB, and automatically writes an argument for you, a political argument, which you can then post online and get credit for. And I don't know quite how that might influence the way knowledge is, it is sort of, you know, the way that the internet makes us think and makes us believe and makes us, but, you know, that way it's sort of taking away a bit of thought from us. And, it's outsourcing our arguments for us. Maybe AI won't have that impact. But, yeah, I suppose that's just where my train of thought was heading. And I think my train of thought's starting to derail. So I'll put the brake on and stop there. Yeah, thanks very much.
Thanks, Mike, and that's an appreciated observation. We're old friends and comrades. And as I remember, I think you're a philosophy graduate, are you not? Yeah. Sometimes it shows.
Thank you.
And that's meant in a good way, really. Yeah, thank you. No, thanks for that, Mike. Anybody else would like to? Would anybody else like to have something to say on this? To follow up, maybe from what Mike and Paddy have contributed. Oh, Freddie, you're muted at the moment.
Yeah, I hadn't really intended. Can you hear me now? Yeah.
Loud and clear.
Yeah, good. I hadn't really intended saying anything as interesting as I found John's address analysis there of the internet, etc. I mean, well, one thing that did immediately amuse me, John was saying about the old Glasgow branch. After its meetings, its outdoor meetings, would frequent a pub, etc. And there have been occasions where perhaps one word led to another. And it did remind me of that, and that tickled me a little bit of an occasion. I think it was a pub called the Red Lion. I can't remember if it was in Renfield Street in Glasgow or not, but that's by the by. But I'm sure it's called the Red Lion, where an altercation took place when some individuals were taking exception to the discussion that myself and some of the party members were having. But that resulted, and I couldn't wait until the Monday to go and see the GP. It did end up a casualty, and it brought back memories. Not particularly pleasant ones, but anyway, it brought back memories anyway. But, I mean, for me, see, I mean, I would describe myself as relatively new to the internet. And it's maybe only the last several months that I've started engaging in it. Primarily with what other comrades perhaps posted, etc., and so on. And I found it, I'm actually finding it quite useful at times. But an observation I've made is that certainly as of yet, and other comrades or other listeners might be able to clarify some things. But I've tended to find that what you might want to call a sort of left-wing groups, etc., seem to be more prevalent on the internet than what you might describe as right-wing. And without going into trying to you know, give examples of left and right, etc. I think you know what I mean in terms of sort of socialist type leaning, and a lot that there seems to be more there, and I've certainly found that quite informative at times. Some of the stuff that's on that, but I mean, I think it was also something that occurred to me was that I think it was last week or the week before. I can't remember off the top of my head, but I mentioned at that time there, it might have been last week, about Brandolini's Law, and you know, again tonight, that it reminded me of this. And sometimes some of the stuff that's on there, I mean, to me it seems quite sort of transparently bullshit at times, the ideas that are coming forward. And I tend to ignore them personally. I could well be wrong, of course. Maybe some of what I think is bullshit isn't acting in bullshit or conspiracies, etc. Maybe not. But as I was rightly reminded of about a week or so, or two weeks ago, in terms of Brandolini's Law, sometimes it takes that long to try and disprove something. it's hardly worthwhile engaging in that exercise to try and disprove someone. So, I mean, I think for me generally, if it doesn't sound right, you know, I would just tend to ignore it anyway. But I think that overall, there is some good stuff about the some good aspects to the internet, and it's certainly for us as socialists in trying to get our case across has been a help. You know, maybe not a great numerical help, but certainly getting it out there and getting it out there quicker than perhaps what we could have done historically in organising meetings and such, like public meetings or public debates or street meetings. It's allowing us another avenue to go down. So I think that overall, the internet has been advantageous. I mean, I see Moggy there, and I think Moggy's in New Zealand. Is that right? Is it correct? Yeah, Moggy's in New Zealand. I mean, I wouldn't have thought of this 50 years ago about being able to sit here and see somebody sitting there in New Zealand with the same sort of ideas as ourselves and such like. So, yeah, I mean, perhaps exercising or certainly exercising some caution on what we get driven with is worthwhile having second thoughts about. But I think that overall, the internet is something that we could and do use or try and use to in case of spreading the socialist case. So, but I was to say, what amused me initially was this altercation that took place in the Red Lion in Glasgow. And, oh, you're going back over 50 years now that happened. So it was nothing new in having these sort of things at times. But anyway, I enjoyed what John was saying overall. Thank you.
Thanks, Freddie. That was eloquent as ever. Thanks ever so much for your contribution. And I'm relieved that after the Red Lion, that as far as I'm aware, Glasgow branch, at least for some time, decamped to the far more civilised Horseshoe Bar. which is my favourite bar in Glasgow.
I know, Andy, but that was without its difficulties at times also. But there was another, I won't go on, there was another one that I could recall, but I'll leave it at that for the moment. Thank you.
Thanks, Freddie. I've got a hand up from, it may be Joy or it may be Howard, who is with Joy.
It's Howard here, Andy.
With Joy?
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Excellent, excellent.
But we're not going to speak together.
Uh-huh, okay. No.
All right, yeah.
It's good to have you.
Just to take up a couple of the things I've heard already from, as it were, the floor speakers. Thanks very much, John, for the talk as well. From something Paddy said, and also something Freddie said. I mean, Paddy said it's only thanks to the internet that we're doing this here and now and there. It's a benefit to us. Can't disagree with that. And Freddie said 15 years ago this would have been unimaginable. He's right, it would have been. But yet 15 years ago, it was already pretty difficult to get people to come to, let's say, physical meetings, whether visitors or whether party members. It was getting increasingly difficult. And from that point of view, the coming of the internet, in particular, the coming of Zoom, which only really found its feet with the lockdown, has been a sort of boon to the party. I mean, we're small. Small organisations suffer a lot from isolation. And we're isolated enough as it is. How much more isolated would we be if we couldn't meet like this, and if branches couldn't meet like this occasionally as well, monthly or however often they meet? So that's definitely a positive from our point of view. I mean, in a way, less of a positive for bigger organisations, which have always had other means of contacting their members and getting together and so on, getting publicity and the like. So, yes, you know, this is something which is which, you know, I definitely say is a benefit to the party. And the way in which we're able to sort of contact one another more or less willy-nilly, the way in which if people want to join the party, the way they're most likely to join is on the internet. As it is, we don't get masses of applications, but how many would we get if we didn't have the way of joining via the party's website? We get very few indeed now from people attending branches or simply writing on Spectre head office or that kind of thing. So it's been a sort of lifeline. I don't know if anybody's seen, I think some of us have seen the correspondence that's sort of been around this week, that one or two people sent round, Darren, Adam, about this chappy who visited head office and has written something about it on his blog. Not that complimentary, but sort of, you know, slightly fond of the party anyway, known the party for a long time. And, you know, the fact of the matter is, you know, whether that's positive or negative, it's publicity, which we couldn't have had in the past. You know, we couldn't have had that kind of publicity or any other kind of publicity. And I'm not saying the result of that is that we would have been sort of, you know, long gone by now, but you know, we're in a bit of a trough at the moment. There's no doubt about that. Most of us would agree with that. But we're nevertheless surviving to a significant extent through the fact that we're able to, you know, still put our case via the internet. The fact that we're still able to meet via the internet, we're still able to communicate with other people. And Freddie brought this up as well. We've got similar, if not identical ideas to the internet as well.
Share things on Facebook.
And Joy's just whispered to me, share things on Facebook as well. Yes, that's part of it, certainly. Anyway, few thoughts there.
Thanks, Howard. Thanks, Joy. Yeah, that's all good stuff. And I think we're over to Dougie now.
Hi, it was an interesting talk. I mean, I think some things influence people quite a lot. You know, I mean, a lot of people read von Däniken and things like that. But, I mean, one of the things I noticed recently was the ITV thing, or I don't know if it was Channel 4, you know, about the postmaster scandal, you know, when these people were accused of fraud when they had nothing to do with fraud or whatever. And Tony Blair sort of ignored them. But when they made a programme, you know, a million people signed a petition for her to give back her MBE. But of course, she got a few million pounds in bonuses, and there's no mechanism for her to hand that back, really, you know, the head of the post office or whatever. So, but I mean, that kind of thing can influence people, and the internet can influence people. I know there's a lot of left wing stuff on the internet. A lot of it's mainly criticizing the Conservatives, really, you know. But I mean, there are people who criticize Labour as well, really, you know, from a left wing point of view. So, I mean, we can get our ideas across sometimes on Facebook and on the internet. But I found it quite fascinating that they started to take it seriously. You know, when a programme was made about the postmaster scandal, I mean, some people killed themselves over this, really. You know, they went to prison and they hadn't been fraudulent at all, really. You know, it's a big scandal, but it only really came to a head when they made a programme about it. Yeah, yeah. So just point that out, really. Yeah. So that's all I want to say, really.
Yeah, thanks, Dougie. Yeah, I think I think anybody here would agree, really, around the way that these ordinary people, these ordinary workers, were treated was appalling, and it is clearly another one of those ruling class establishment cover ups to cover their backs. Meanwhile, where they take all the financial rewards and keep them. I know quite a bit about that story, actually, because I'm an avid Radio 4 listener, and I also read Private Eye. I have a subscription to Private Eye, which I'd urge anybody really to have. It's not very expensive. It's around £34 a year, I think, at the moment. And Private Eye have been covering that that particular issue there with the postmasters in Britain, for sub-postmasters, for a long, long time, you know, many, many years. You know, even, you know, the dear old BBC as well periodically put out documentaries about it over the last, certainly the last decade. But it took that documentary from ITV to really ruffle the ruling class about it. And it was just heartbreaking. I haven't actually watched it. I've got to be honest with you. I haven't actually watched that programme. I've got to make a diary date to watch it on BBC iPlayer. I do intend to. But the story is absolutely heartbreaking, really. And I think one of the things that struck me about that, and I don't want to go off the subject about the internet here, and I won't ramble on it, I try to promise, is that I think it was just the sheer ordinariness of the people. You know, those people, they were working people. They weren't rich. They weren't especially impoverished. But they were just hardworking people trying to do the right thing as they see it in this capitalist society. And they got shat on massively by the establishment. And I think a lot of people can relate to that. You know, it seems to have become a massive counterpoint, really, to the way things have been run and managed at the moment. I don't think it necessarily gives any impetus to our arguments, really. But it may make a lot of people think about questioning, you know, things more than they were doing so before. So I don't have any hands up at the moment, following Dougie's interesting observation there. Is there anybody that would like to raise their hand, make a point, make an observation, just give us your thoughts?
I should point out, Andy, that if you're going to watch that drama, you won't find it on iPlayer because it's on ITV.
Okay, that just shows you how tech savvy I am then, Paddy, doesn't it? Yeah, thank you very much for that. You've just embarrassed me in front of how many people? About 10? So, hey ho, that's the way it goes. Right, thanks, Paddy. So whilst I'm blushing, please spare me my blushes and come up with something to take my woes away.
Just something on that programme. I don't know if others noticed, and this won't spoil it for anyone, I don't think. There was an old judge in one episode who didn't seem to be in control of his own court over which he was presiding. So much was he looked quite bemused, and it didn't portray it as though the post office was in control of him, but given that he looked so bemused and not in control, I thought, well, is that deliberate? Because the post office was in charge of these prosecutions. I don't know to what extent that was based on an actual judge who was not in control, because it just seemed not very characteristic of judges who are usually, even if they're not particularly well-informed, are quite often quite arrogant people, and certainly don't like to appear not in control. But he seemed like an utterly bemused old man who didn't know what was going on and just seemed to accept, oh, well, if they're saying these people did this and this software is saying there's money missing, then it must be missing. And nobody was looking for actual money to check. Did this correspond to any reality? That was the awful thing about that. And a lot of people learned, I think, for the first time in their lives. Because there was one guy, one postmaster, he said, it's all right, I'll just tell the truth and we'll be okay. And he even said the thing about British justice, you know, British justice will prevail and I'll be found not guilty. And of course, well, no surprise to us, that didn't pan out. That's not what happens. If you're a member of the working class, quite often if you're accused of something, well, that's it. You'll be bundled off to a jail cell where you'll be kept until such times as you can get to the bottom of this matter. It's only members of the ruling class who can be sure that they can avail themselves of some kind of notion of justice.
Thanks, John. Howard and Joy? Joy and Howard?
Okay, yeah. Okay, yeah. Me again. Andy?
Yes, of course. Yeah, go ahead. Sorry,
okay. Howard. No. Since we're talking about the post office scandal, again, I mean, you know, the fact that it's come out in the way it has is largely due to the media, you know, TV media in this case. But it's something I've been following for a number of years, and I've just been increasingly appalled with the primal injustice of it. I mean, it's been known about for years. There's this reporter on BBC, Nick, I can't think of his second name, who's been doing documentaries on it for about 10 years. It's been making no difference whatever. There's been this stuff in private eye you talk about, Ian Hislop talking about it all over the place. Nothing at all. It's astonishing. And the extraordinary thing, the most extraordinary thing for me, is that these people were able to be prosecuted not by the British state, but by the post office. The post office actually was entitled to take people to court under its own steam, with its own resources, and get them sent to prison. I mean, what kind of way is that to run the capitalist system? That, you know, the duly elected government is not in charge of the so-called justice system. Totally extraordinary. I mean, but the way it's exploded now is something else, isn't it? It's the kind of thing that I don't think we've sort of ever quite seen before. And who could have imagined? People who made the films, who made this series, I mean, they had a bit of trouble getting it put on because they thought not many people would watch it. Well, they were pleasantly surprised. Good. God, the more these bastards are punished, and they probably won't be, but the more they are, the better. I know it won't get us a tad nearer socialism, but even so.
Okay. Is that your point, Howard? Are you still speaking?
That's my non-point, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, thanks. I think everybody's sort of would share the same perspective on that, really. I think you made, I'm going off a little bit, I don't want to start another discussion here, but yeah, what is interesting is the way that in that case, I don't have a big grasp on all the major detail of it, on the legal side of it, but there seemed suddenly to be sort of schism between the judiciary and the formal I'm not sure if I'm going to use the right term here, but basically the elected government in terms of how the law should be applied once the politicians realised that they were in the shit. Suddenly, you know, all the usual legal kind of considerations were thrown out the window, down the plug hole, whatever, you know. And normally the elected politicians, wrongly in my view, actually, tend to defer and kowtow to the judiciary. And it seemed as though they were willing to just go against that because the heat was so much on them. I'm not sure if anybody else has got any kind of view on that. If not, that's fine. But it's long been a concern of mine that the judges have too much, power, basically, because nobody elects them. You know, whether or not we like the government of the day, which obviously we don't like any of them, they are the elected representatives and about the best you've got in this form of democracy. Judges aren't elected by the people. That's just my observation on Howard's point there. Coming back to the internet, we're sort of getting on a little bit towards 9 o'clock now, UK time. John's talk was very instructive, and it was a huge subject to try to cover. But the areas that John covered were very interesting. Any final observations, please? No? No? Okay, have we reached a natural sort of ending here? I'll just check. I'll go through the... Yeah, I can't see any hands up. Okay, so it's looking a little bit as though we've kind of talked ourselves out on this subject for this evening. Now, Paddy introduced it. I wasn't quite here at the very start. Paddy, is there anything you'd like to say if you're still around?
About this, no. I just thought I'd mention that the talk next week is on contemporary reactions to climate change. I think I've got that right. Adam might correct me. From Richard Field. So that's going to be next Friday. I think he's talking about how various sort of political trends are kind of dealing with the climate change issue. So that'll be next week. And thanks to John for a really good talk, and thanks to Andy for sharing.
Yep. Thanks, everybody. Have a good week next week. Take care.